good. Welcome back to another Barnes Bullet Points podcast. I love how that just introed in by that.
That was good.
All right. I'm here with Greg Sloan today, Mitchell Cookson, and we're going to have a nice little conversation. I think that it makes sense to drop this when we're going to drop it right here before hunting season. And that's kind of an introduction to long range shooting, right? Like, we make long range hunting projectiles, we make ammo that can perform at those extended ranges. Let's talk about like what it takes to actually kind of shoot that, right? And if you want to be a long range shooter, and we're not saying hunting, right? It can be NRL hunter, it can be PRS, it can just be you want to extend your range when you're at the range or shooting rocks or whatever that it is. Let's kind of talk about that.
Yeah. So one thing I think right off the bat, obviously long range shooting and long range hunting, there is crossover.
Right.
Absolutely. But I think it is important to at least recognize, especially for somebody that's brand new to long range shooting, whether it be they're trying to hunt or they're just shooting a match, there are differences. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, things to understand with terminal performance, especially at extended ranges, that you don't have to worry about if you're just shooting still, if you're just shooting paper,
right?
Versus if you're trying to ethically kill an animal at extended distance.
Yeah.
So that's absolutely something to think about. The equipment.
Yeah, and I guess before we get like super deep into that, Mitchell, what would you consider long range shooting? Like when does it become quote long range? And the reason I'm asking that is because I'm sure that we have three people on the podcast and we have 1,000 people listening or however many people listening, and everybody's going to have probably a different answer. So that's why I wanted to ask it.
Yeah. That is a really good question. I mean, we've gone to tons of trade shows over the years in all parts of the country, and it's pretty crazy what people consider, the variation of what they consider long range. You talk to a guy on the East Coast or in the Midwest and they think long range is 150 yards. They want shotgun slugs with high BCs, and it's like, guys, that's not really that far.
Right.
And then you live out west and you talk to guys and they think a mile is long range.
Right.
But I think when you look at long range, to me, that's maybe 450, 500 yards. That's really when the wind starts to play a major effect.
Okay.
And it depends on your cartridge too. If you're shooting a 6.5 Grendel or a 223 or something, that's a lot. That distance is a lot harder to hit a target than, say, a 7 PRC with a really good BC.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that,
yeah, I mean, I if you're
four or 500 yards, you really start to compound your, some of the errors you can run into and wind and everything else. But that's kind of what I think long range. That's usually what I think.
Yeah. And I think, a simple way to look at it is really any distance, because there are variables, as Mitchell brought up. It's really any distance that you now need to consider the effects of gravity and wind, right? We start to correct for drop and drift,
right?
You know, and obviously that's going to change with muzzle velocity, BC, your conditions. But that's a piece of it, is any distance that you now have to really consider and correct for, whether that's by holding over with a reticle, or whether that's dialing a turret to correct for that difference in drop from your original zero,
yep.
Any distance at which you have to now consider and correct for drop and drift.
Okay.
And you should also bring into it the precision piece of it, especially when it comes to hunting and match shooting, obviously, for success, you know. And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself and we're talking more about limitations, but, you know, the difference of a group that you're capable of at 100 yards versus 500 yards obviously has to be considered.
Right.
So, but yeah, I agree. It's like a simple term from a hunter perspective, and especially when I'm talking about rifle hunting. Really, it's mostly, it's that 350, but really it's that 400 and beyond.
Okay. Yeah. I was totally thinking what you were going to say, like yardage wise, right? Like, I mean, I was thinking in that 500 to 600 yard range is kind of where you're starting to really see effects. But I do like how you had a more detailed answer, right? It's not so much a yardage game. It's actually just when that particular cartridge, that particular bullet is actually starting to make larger drops between, like you said, gravity and,
right.
you know, is having wind. I think that's a really good way of thinking about it, is that long range can be different depending on if you're shooting a 30-30 or a 30-06 or a 300 Weatherby Magnum.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, if you look at it that way, like that's an interesting perspective, and I like that thought.
Yeah, and you can come at it from the angle, and I think Mitchell's discussed this before on another podcast, but you don't have to shoot 500, 600, 700, 800 yards to see the benefits of a higher performing projectile, and mostly because of the wind. Like you've brought mm-hmm. it before, you know, like our 7PRC 160 grain LRX, it's an awesome performer. You know, anyone who's shot that load can see that. Good velocity, good accuracy, good BC, good terminal performance. And you could think, why do I need that 160 LRX? I'm not going to shoot an elk at 700 yards. But if you go look at the difference of drift at 400 yards in a 10-mile-an-hour crosswind, even if 450 is your limit, there is an advantage even at 400 yards with that projectile versus if you were just going to load, say, a 150 grain TTSX.
Okay.
You know, it's mostly in the wind drift at those closer ranges. You know, because you can correct for the gravity, right?
Right.
You know, and we'll get into how to do that.
Yeah.
And obviously, there's a little deeper where you can get into hit probability and improvements
right.
from precision, where that high BC can also help on that end. But really, you could look at it from a simple term of, well, I can always know what, calculate, and correct for my drop.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's the drift, it's the wind that really starts to kick your butt.
Right. So I got to embarrass. Embarrassing story here that I gotta get off my chest. Last year, I missed an elk at 300 yards because of wind in Wyoming. It was you think long range, 300 yards, it's not really long range, but when the wind's blowing 50-60 miles an hour, the trees are bent over, you're shooting over a 200-foot canyon.
Yeah,
that's it blew it right off the elk, and I missed. It was biggest elk I've ever shot at.
Ooh.
Missed it. Never got it.
Oh. No, that's a good one. That's a great example because it's something that, like you said, at that distance, you're in the moment, you're going to overlook most likely.
Right.
You know, you're not going to be thinking about, I got to hold for wind at 300 yards.
Yeah.
You know, with a, and I don't know what you're shooting, but it was probably something that was capable, you know, fast and had a good enough BC. And
I'm assuming you were shooting your 6.5 300.
I was, yeah.
So shooting the 127.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would love to dive a little bit deeper into that story before we go on, right? Is like, how much were you calculating for wind at all before you made the shot?
I did. So okay. We had been
hunting. Don't go too far because I have like follow-ups with that, right? Okay. So you were calculating for wind. What did you think the wind was doing?
Where I was at, I held for 20.
20 mile an hour wind. Okay. Yeah. So how much was that hold, if you could remember, give or take?
It wasn't that much. So I calculated for 10 and then doubled it.
Okay.
It was only 5 or 6 inches. Mm-hmm. And it was quartering. The elk was quartering away, too. So I made the mistake of not aiming at the far shoulder.
Got it.
I aimed at the near shoulder instead of the far shoulder. I was only holding 6 inches on the near shoulder.
Okay. So 6 inches. And then to get deeper in the story, what was the wind? What do you think that the wind was doing once that you did miss that bull?
I think it was honestly in that 50 mile an hour range.
Wow. Okay.
Because I was down low, I was prone, and I was in a sheltered spot. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a ton of wind where I was at, and I looked where the elk were.
Ton of wind? You're saying you calculated for 20 and you still don't think that there was a ton of wind?
Where I was
got it. Okay.
So where I was at, there wasn't a ton of wind because I was sheltered. And where the elk were at, I couldn't see a ton of wind. It wasn't something crazy. But as you get higher in elevation, that's what we can get more into. But a lot of people don't think that elevation makes a big difference. But when you're shooting over a canyon that's a couple hundred feet deep, the higher you go up in the air, the stronger the wind is. So where I was sheltered, I was prone, low to the ground. I held for 20 because I knew the wind was going to increase over the canyon. but I didn't know to that magnitude. So after I missed, I was, you know, everything was going through my head. I'm wondering what the heck is going on. We dropped down to go look for blood. Well, I couldn't see the trees in front of me. And down low, I mean, they were trying to bend over. They were just, the wind was absolutely ripping through that canyon. And then I was shooting over 200 feet. And, yeah, I honestly think it was about 50 miles an hour in there.
Wow.
So it's just, you're low to the ground, you're sheltered, you're shooting over canyon. And I just didn't think any of that through. I was so jacked up in the moment. And
yeah,
you think 300 yards, that's a chip shot. And didn't aim at the far shoulder, didn't account for enough wind, didn't think about the height. Completely missed it.
Wow. So sheltered, you thought that it was 50. How much did you miss the elk by?
I have no idea. It couldn't have been by much. I was.
Did you see impact?
No.
Okay.
So my buddy was on the spotting scope.
Yep.
And he flinched when I shot.
Nice.
Didn't see. So he told me, he's like, I think you hit it. And then I quick did a follow up shot, just trying to get another one in it. Missed again.
And did you see impact that time?
No.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, I have no idea, but that's the only.
So if you think that it was 30 miles an hour more, then you potentially missed it by a foot and a half, 2 foot, potentially.
By where I was aiming, yes. Okay. I bet.
But you probably didn't miss the.
It was probably only six inches. Couple inches in front of his brisket.
Yeah,
got it.
But yeah, I mean that still haunts me today.
Yeah.
That was the biggest elk I've shot at, and to miss at 300 yards. And I had time.
Right.
That was the thing. I got all jacked up. I thought 300 yards, this is an easy shot. And I rushed it and I missed. And yeah, it haunts me.
How big was the bull? Roughly.
Obviously. I bet 340 plus.
Okay.
Just beautiful 6 point. There wasn't a weak point on it. Just good tine length, super heavy, wide, long beams. It might have, 340 plus. I tried not to look too much, but we were looking at elk all week, and that was, I seen it through the binoculars. I didn't even look twice. I went straight for the rifle. It was obvious.
Nice. Okay. Well, not nice, I guess, because you missed the bull, and I hate that for you, but perfect learning experience for us to be able to, like, talk about. I mean, obviously, this is more like an intro podcast of just understanding drop and like how all that matters. And I think that it should also be, you know, your limitations, right? And trying to be honest with yourself. I think that that's extremely important as you extend range. One thing that I've always kind of looked at shooting, right? It's easy to say, yeah, I can shoot 1,000 yards or a mile or something when you're on a bench and you can kind of walk it in, if you will, for where you're trying to hit it. But you start to get into realistic situations. And even in a PRS match, NRL, Hunter, whatever that it be, you'll quickly see just how, you know, it's humbling in a way. And I think that wind does end up playing more into it than, I shouldn't say more into it than the shooter, but like, for the dialing portion of it, right? Like, that's pretty simple. I mean, that's just math in general. As long as you get a good range for your target, right, you can figure out what you need to dial. But if there's, I mean, even a 5-10 mile an hour wind at 900 yards makes a pretty damn big difference.
Yeah, and I think you brought this up already. This is just more of an introduction.
Yeah.
You know, we want to follow up with more in-depth,
right?
You know, more technical future episode that will be good, but we want to start with an introduction. But I do think it's good to address up front, especially when we're talking about hunting and long ranges. Obviously, there's a lot of the ethical portion of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't ignore it. There's a lot of opinions on both sides or somewhere in the middle on long range hunting, you know, whether it's ethical or not. But regardless, whether it's a 500 yard shot or a 200 yard shot, you know, I always come and look at it from the perspective of know your equipment, prove it, be honest with yourself,
right?
Know your limitations, know when to say the shot doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, the conditions have to be right. There are a lot of variables And I think that's one of the biggest things to bring up to somebody that's new and even experienced at this. What you do at the range, we like to always, I think it's just human nature. Most shooters, I think, like to probably think they're better than they are.
Right.
You know, oh, I hit that 1,000-yard target. Look how awesome that was.
Yeah.
But they really step back. How many first round impacts do you make in hunting conditions from field positions?
Yeah.
You know, that's what it's going to be in the field. The canyon shots, the winds that are unknown.
Right.
You know, you really got to step back and say, what is your hit percentage on first round impacts at what distance? You know, just because you walked it in on a 4-foot by 4-foot steel plate right. at 1,000 yards a couple times,
yeah.
you might have felt that that was awesome and it was really fun. But okay, go do that 10 times on a MOA size plate at 1,000 yards.
Right.
And tell me how many times from field positions in unknown conditions you go make a first round impact.
Well, since apparently this is going to be a, what did you call it? Telling on yourself or having to admit something?
Just embarrassing.
Embarrassing. Stories. Okay. So I'll play along. And I think that Greg might have a story that he wants to tell, or maybe he doesn't, but, yeah. So I have one as well. A couple years back, I was bear hunting, and this goes with your knowing your own limitations. I ended up shooting a bear at like 7:30 with 7 PRC. And I almost had to talk myself into making the shot. Granted, I did. I will say that, right? I did first round impact, killed the bear ran 50 yards and fell dead, right? But it was weird because that ended up being the longest shot that I've ever taken an animal at, a big game animal. But I had to kind of talk myself into it. I knew that the gun could do it. I knew that I've shot that gun at 1,000 yards, right? But keeping super tight groups at 1,000 yards is tough for, I don't care who you are. It could be Mark and Tommy. I mean, well, right. Maybe not Mark and Tommy, but you get my point, right? Like, but I will tell myself, right, is that I almost had to talk myself into making that shot. And then I ended up doing it. So it's like, you know, now you try to think back, well, is 700 yards technically, should that be your limit? I will say that like in most hunting situations, 500 yards is kind of where I try to hold myself to mm-hmm. or less. Right? And we've talked on multiple different podcasts that if you're at 700 yards, unless there's a big canyon, which there was on this bear, so I could not physically get closer.
Right.
You know, even if you're at 700 yards, most of the time you can get to 500 or 400, right, on an animal. So I guess in this revealing podcast, we're having come to Jesus with ourselves, if you will, as we're doing this. So, but also, I mean, I think that this is good for the audience to hear, right? Is that we've had, I mean, we shoot a lot, right? I would think that we shoot a lot. We've all hunted a lot. We've all taken a lot of animals, right? And we still have those mess up times, or you get in the moment and you think that you're better than you are, or you have to like kind of talk yourself into that situation and then you end up doing it or you don't do it, right?
Right.
Apparently the devil and the angel on my shoulder in that moment, the devil won for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
go ahead.
On that point, I mean, you can get humbled pretty dang quick.
Yeah.
I mean, with my rifle, I took it out dozens of times that year, have a nice range by my house. I'll shoot generally 500 to 700 yards, just check my doe between hunts, make sure I'm still on. Generally, I'm pretty much always in the plate, but I'm on a bench.
All right.
It's not very windy.
Yeah.
But you get confident like that, and then you go out in the field and miss at 300 yards.
Yeah.
And this is me having industrial chronograph equipment, Doppler data.
Yeah.
I have, you know, all the tools and knowledge, and then I go miss at 300 yards.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, field shooting in the field is way different than shooting on the bench, and doesn't matter, 300 yards, you can still whiff something really bad.
Yeah, I will caveat before, I know Sloan has a thought, so like I want to jump into it real quick. Talking about, you said your spotter was like watching and then he flinched. I literally had the exact same thing. I had a guy that was like essentially spotting for me, and we had like a phone scope thing on it, right? And And when I made the shot, and I was shooting suppressed of all things, right? So it's like, shouldn't have really flinched. But he ended up like, he was messing with it and kind of like holding it steady, and he still flinched. So again, right? Like, I had no idea if I had impact. I felt really good. I saw the bear react, right? And everything. We obviously would go over there, could not find blood, but ended up just kind of walking into where it was and dead animal. But
yeah,
saying that, it is always nice if you're going to be doing quote long range shooting or long for you, have a spotter. It's super important. So yeah,
and I totally agree, have a spotter though, but it's in depending on the scenario and what application you're doing, it's sometimes as critical as the shooter. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen multiple times where an inexperienced spotter can bring a lot of error and fault into the scenario.
Yeah,
and,
you know, have bad calls.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, misinformation, reading wind wrong. You know, if you are more of a target scenario, you're trying to make a correction on from an impact where they thought the bullet actually impacted and they're right, giving you that call versus reality.
Yeah.
I see a lot of faults there. But yeah, a good spotter, and that comes from experience, reading the wind, reading the conditions, you know, reading the trace of the bullet. But, you know, I think we probably need to take a step back a little bit and say, since this isn't an introduction to long range,
yeah,
and we're probably going to focus a little more on long range hunting,
right,
versus just shooting. It's kind of, where do you get started? You know, what does that mean? What kind of equipment do I need? You know, do I need a $5,000 custom rifle with the top of the line scope that costs $3,000, and I need this cool wind meter and this app and this Kestrel and this rangefinder and this shooting tripod and these bags. And next thing you know, yes, you're like $10,000 worth of equipment. And eventually, depending how far you want to take it, you'll probably get there.
Right.
But to start out, you know, you got to have, and I'm going to keep this super top level and pretty quick.
Yeah.
To me though, you got to have a good shooting rifle. Mm-hmm. Okay. What does that mean? Well, for practical perspective for hunting, generally it's going to be a rifle that consistently hold one MOA or better.
Okay.
That's where I view it. If it's half MOA, better. Right. Great. But reality is, if you can consistently hold one MOA, you know, 90%+ of the time when you're on paper, okay, we've got a good shooting rifle. It's having some form of chronograph, and that's not absolutely necessary because there's other ways to gather your drop data, but it's a big help knowing to start with how fast is your bullet going.
Right.
You know, measuring your velocity. Today, there's a lot of different equipment available,
yeah,
and pretty affordable chronographs. And there's ways around that. You don't have to have one, but it's a big help.
Right.
Having a good scope. And I think people can get carried away with the power of the scope, the variable. They think they got to have a, you know, some giant 30+ power on the high end. No, like for a hunting rifle, I like to be in that 4-16 range. 3-18 is best. Yep. I love it because, yep, it gives me a good broad range of objective. Mm-hmm. Everything from a good field of view on the low end. You know, this is generally, it's a hunting rifle, I want it to be versatile.
Yep.
But having something in that 4-16, 3-18, you don't need to go above 20. You really don't.
Yeah.
And I think many times it can almost be a fault where people are too high of a power and they don't have a big enough field of view.
Yep.
Having some form of a ballistic solution, right? The ballistic app, you know, you got to understand your BC. And I'm going to let Mitchell give an explanation of what that is from a basic level.
Okay.
And then it's the range time, you know. And whether you're a factory ammo shooter or you're a hand loader, it's going to the range, dialing in your gun, starting from a good zero, whether that's 100-yard or 200-yard zero, and then it's building that data, right? Building that dope, you know, that says, this is the data, we've recorded it, we can refer back to it, you know, on this day, at this gun, this ammo type, this bullet, this BC, you know, from 100 yard zero, this is what my drop was at 400, this is what it was at 500. You kind of walk it out.
Right.
You know, and you kind of true up that trajectory so that if you're dialing or holding over, depending on your setup, whether you're using a, you know, a holdover reticle or a dialable returnable turret, and we can get, mm-hmm, into that with kind of what's, you know, required on a basic level.
Yeah.
But you got to have a way to, again, you got to have a way to correct for that drop and that drift.
Right.
And we can get into different options there, whether you're dialing wind or holding wind, you're trying to guess, or you're using reticles with hash marks. You know, we can totally deep dive into this on so many levels. But that's kind of the basic equipment to me. Bipod, a bag.
I mean, with all this equipment that you just talked about, you have not talked about having ammo at all.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean, obviously we are ammo bullet company, right?
Right.
are you doing that more to say that, like, as long as you have, obviously we know that you're going to have ammo, but it doesn't matter, quote, what ammo you have, because as long as you have consistent data, then you can figure this stuff out? Or,
You know, and I hadn't covered that yet. It's a great point. I think one of the biggest faults that I see with long-range hunting mm-hmm. is the lack of understanding of what's required on the terminal performance side.
Yeah.
Accuracy is a huge piece of it. You know, shot placement absolutely matters. It's critical. Precision matters. High BC matters. And that plays into the terminal performance. But it's also having the right projectiles. You know, we take, a lot of times people, end users, can take projectiles and put them in an application that was outside of their design, you know, and they think, well, if I can hit this steel target at 1,000 yards, it means I can hit this elk at 1,000 yards. Mm-hmm. And there's no consideration into what is my retained velocity?
Right.
What is my retained energy? What material is that bullet? What design functions does it have? Mm-hmm. You know, where is its limitations on expansion, weight retention, penetration, you know, the whole terminal performance wounding aspect of it? You know, that's critical. It's absolutely vital. And it's one thing that actually, you know, kind of to your point, is I think highly overlooked.
Yeah.
And misunderstood.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, you know, not to kind of get on our soapbox here, right? But it's like everybody wants to have the latest, greatest rifle. Everybody wants to have the highest dollar scope that they can put on it, and then they'll go buy the cheapest ammo in the world. I'm not saying that our listeners do that, because I'm assuming that if they're listening to the Bullet Points podcast that they already like Barnes for some reason, right? But you see it all the time, right? These guys want to go buy new rifles and everything, and they're in the store, and then the first thing they do is they go buy, they're like, well, I need to go break in my rifle, so I'm going to buy the cheapest thing on the shelf, rather than being like, no, I want to break it in with the same thing that I'm going to hunt with, or that I'm going to shoot my competition with, or whatever. So, okay, I'll step down off my soapbox.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a great point. Generally, as a consumer, you should, if it's advertised for long range, that's, if you're going to shoot long range, you should buy something that's advertised for that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think, well, I heard online that these match bullets are awesome at long range. Well, they might be, but they might not be. They're not designed for that intent. We make our LRXs, that's our long range X bullet, and that's, they're designed to expand at long range, but we've tested our match burners, which are made to shoot steel. We've shot those at long range, more or less curious, and some work awesome and some don't. Some right. just tumble.
Well, yeah. And when you're saying like shooting long range, right? Like, I guess talk a little bit about like the distance, but also like what do you mean by some perform at long range, some don't?
I don't know. We've shot 600 to 900 yards into ordnance gel. And
so it's more about the gel.
Wounding.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. That's what I was trying to get at, right?
Really. And it is good to clarify, if the goal is precision and high BC and accuracy and shooting steel and paper mm-hmm. at super long distances, the match burner is awesome. You know, at least the boat tail versions that are designed for long range. But when it comes to terminal, the other side of that, what happens when it hits the target?
Yeah.
You know? And that's where, like Mitchell said, there are some that work, some that don't. And that's not just ours. We do a lot of competitive evaluation. Mm-hmm. We test a lot of bullets from different manufacturers. And I think there are some assumptions made and some misunderstandings in the shooting world of long-range hunting, long-range shooting, where the thought is, well, if it's a thin jacketed bullet with a high BC, it's got to be good for long-range hunting right. because it's going to expand better.
Yeah.
It's absolutely not the case. Sometimes it's the case, depending on the bullet, depending on the caliber, the cartridge, the launch velocity, the impact velocity. Sometimes they will expand pretty well. And depending on shot placement and size of game, it can be, you know, really good results. But I've also seen plenty of jacketed match type bullets that are target bullets that are high BC. They're awesome bullets. They shoot unreal. And the thought is, well, that bullet has great expansion at 800 or 1,000 yards because it's a thin jacketed bullet. It's going to expand better. It's going to come apart. It's going to transfer that energy to the animal.
Right.
in reality, they don't do anything. They don't expand. You might get it to tumble. You might get it to break the nose cone off. And you might get some form of yaw. And really, that's it. And so it's almost a misunderstanding where it's this basic understanding of what's even bring up copper bullets. The thought is, well, copper bullets don't expand at low velocity. Lead core bullets expand better at low velocity. There are instances where that's absolutely true. And you could flip it around and argue the other way, and I have data to prove it, right?
Yeah.
It just, it really is understanding, to Mitchell's point, was that bullet designed for that? You know, and there's times where guys have had success using bullets outside of what they're initially designed for. I mean, you could even look at our match burner. You know, we do not advertise the match burner for hunting.
Yeah.
You know, I have jail data and field data and reports from consumers that you could argue certain bullets in our match burner line can be used successfully for hunting, especially on thin skin game. Now, am I going to go use it on a bull elk that I waited 20 years to draw a tag for? Absolutely not.
Right.
You know, but can you kill a pronghorn with it at 400 yards? Yeah, you can.
We don't recommend that.
Yeah,
but you can.
But you can, right?
Yeah. And then we have the TSX line, TTSX, and LRX. If you shoot a TSX or TTSX long range, it's probably not going to work that well unless you're shooting the 28 NOS, or that one has a little bit modified TSX bullet. But LRX is designed for long range, and it works at long range. We modified that function window, so it loses a little bit of weight at higher velocity, but then it also expands long range. So whether you're shooting copper or lead, generally listen to the manufacturer. Don't just go on Google or, you know, listen to
get on the forums
or something.
There's so many people that just want to jump on a forum, and it's like, well, I saw on, you know, not to call out certain forums, but you see like a Rock Slide, right? And there's a lot of people that are talking about shooting match for long range, shooting match projectiles, right, at long range and killing animals at it. But it's like, literally, it says right there on the box, and it's, most of the time, it's not our match bullets, right? It's other competitors or even the sister company's match grade bullets, right, that they're saying like, oh, yeah, it worked absolutely perfect. It's like, okay, so you have one point of data, but we have decades of data that show you that it's not the right thing. So
yeah, I'm not here to say that it's 100% wrong, but generally you're going to see a ton of variation. Some bullets are going to work great, and the same product line, even a different grain weight or different caliber, can be 100% different.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And, I mean, it's not designed to expand, so some do, some don't.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's worth mentioning that some of these bullets also within the same caliber and weight don't have the consistency bullet to bullet because it wasn't designed, right? There's no controlled expansion. There's no design feature that creates expansion at a given velocity. It's more of a result of a given velocity and an impact in the material, right? And so, and I brought this up before, but I've tested certain bullets from different makers that at the same velocity, I could go shoot 10 bullets at the same velocity and get everything from complete jacket core separation to zero expansion at all.
Wow.
And so that's something to consider.
Yeah.
They're not consistent performing bullets.
Yeah, for sure. I know that you were wanting to turn it over to Mitchell there a little bit ago when we started kind of talking about understanding ballistics, you know, having a ballistic solver, that type of thing, an app. And I got you sidetracked and we went on a crazy bullet talk. So, I mean, obviously we knew it was going to eventually get there. We're a bullet and ammo company, but if you want to kind of get back to that point, I think it'd be great if you can, if I didn't sidetrack it too far.
Yeah.
So Greg talked about the equipment you have, but taking that a step further, you need a ballistic app. You can run it on your computer, you can run it on your phone, and what that app is doing is taking all the data you tell it, and it gives a physics-based solution as to what that bullet's going to do, how much it's going to drop, how much it's going to drift. And I've heard some people say that, you know, it's an approximation. It's absolutely not. It'll get you within a thousandth of an inch, but garbage in equals garbage out. So if you don't have good data going in, that's what makes it inaccurate. But if you give it 100% perfect data, velocity is 100% correct, it's right on BC, your sight height, atmospherics, everything, it's going to give you the exact solution.
Right.
Yeah. So you have to give it good data. And, you know, Greg said, what's the most important, you know, basics of getting set up? I would say BC and muzzle velocity. And you can kind of true that. We'll talk to that in a minute. But the other important thing is a good zero.
Yeah.
If you're shooting, you have to get a zero at some point to put into your solver. So easiest thing to do is shoot at 100 yards, go measure it. A lot of the apps, you don't have to have it exactly at zero. You can have it an inch or two high and you can input that. But if you screw that up, you're going to end up incorrectly adjusting your BC or muzzle velocity when you true up your dope. So get a good zero, make sure that's accurate, make sure your BC and muzzle velocity are accurate, and then you need to go out and actually shoot and verify it and true up your dope.
I think we need to break in quick and get a, because there could be people listening that they hear BC. What does that mean? What is BC?
Yeah, it's hard to cover everything on a introductory podcast.
Let's look at it from like a top level, pretty basic definition. You know, if this is somebody that's, they've shot, they've hunted their whole lives, they hear things, they read things, but they've never really dove into it. What is BC and what does that mean? And what is that even, what's it doing for them? Why do they need that? What's it representing?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to answer.
Especially from an engineer's brain.
A BC is a measurement of how quickly your bullet slows down. So it's a multiplier of your deceleration. And you need that because the ballistic app needs to know how much it's slowing down, how much time it's in the air, how much gravity is affecting it. But it's really a multiplier of your deceleration, how quickly it loses velocity. So if you have a high BC, it's going to lose velocity less quickly, and you're going to retain more velocity downrange. If it has a low BC, it's going to do the opposite. It's going to lose a lot of velocity very quickly. So that's kind of a layman's term of what it is. And that's really important in the ballistic calculator to give it that info to give you accurate drop. And then on the other end, muzzle velocity is just how quickly that bullet is coming out of your barrel. And you can measure that with a Garmin's got that great new chronograph. You can shoot it through sky screens, or you can just go to the box, like on our Vortex box here, 28 Nozzler, 3150. And that's another point of shooting good ammo is we're going to try our best to hit that number right on. We have limits in here. It's going to change depending on barrel length, but if you don't have that equipment, generally you can just look at the box and enter that. And we'll talk about it more in a minute, but you always got to true that data up. But this is going to give you a great starting point.
Yeah.
The BC and the velocity right on the box.
Yeah, one thing I'm going to jump in here quick, I want to bring up too. I think it's important to recognize and understand across the board that there are many variables.
Yep.
Velocity variation, BC variation. You know, when we say, okay, the BC of this given projectile is X, that's an average, right? Over sample size.
Okay.
Shooter variation, conditions, you know, the dispersion, right? And so to Mitchell's point, if the prediction, assuming that all the inputs are as accurate as possible, and as true as possible. If the prediction at that point is indeed accurate, why do I see variation downrange? Well, it's all these other variables, right? Mm-hmm. It's all these other factors playing in. You know, in a perfect world, if every single bullet was going the exact same velocity and had the exact same BC, you know, that is the drop of that bullet. That is the effect of the drift. But when your velocity varies and your BC varies and your group size varies, right, and your shot varies, and your conditions vary, your atmospherics vary, the pressure on the stock varies, your bedding's varying, your scope dialing varies. You know, there's this, it's variable after variable after variable.
So basically nobody should ever shoot long range. Got it.
You could start to look at it that way and say, well, how do I account for all this?
Yeah.
You know, and that's where I think you got to bring it back to a practical perspective of understanding your limitations,
right,
both as you as a shooter and of your equipment. You know, and it's easy to start to go down a rabbit hole to point fingers. You could say, well, I trued this up and my calculation was off. So guess what? Your BC's wrong.
Yeah.
We've heard that one before. I'm sure about every bullet manufacturer has probably heard that. Because it's the easy thing for them to look at, because if they go change the BC in their calculator, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but they can correct for it and true it up, and it says, well, the BC must be this, not that.
So let's go into that. Let's go into truing up, getting your dope, dead on previous engagements.
Yeah.
What is that? I told you garbage in equals garbage out. If you have perfect input, your output's perfect, but it never is. So how do you mitigate that?
Yeah, I think, and that's, I mentioned earlier, you try to control what you can. You're going to try to shoot as consistent performing ammunition as you can, whether it was factory ammo or hand loads. We want to shoot ammunition with low standard deviation of muzzle velocity, right? Because then if we don't have a ton of variance from our, you know, our nominal, our average that we're calculating everything off of, it's that much less variable. BC variation, I honestly think if you're using quality component bullets, you know, I don't think that's something you need to necessarily factor in. I think that's going to just fall into the system average, right? Try to get the best accuracy you can. Trigger time, you know, what are you doing as a shooter? That's a variable you can work on that you can actually control. Having some way to understand atmospherics. What is the temperature? You know, what is the, you know, whether I'm doing density, altitude, or elevation, I've got some sort of weather meter or Kestrel. You know, if nothing else, I'm understanding my location. You know, what is the average temperature? What is the average elevation of that location that I'm going to be shooting in or hunting in? Those things are all important. You know, I think it's misunderstood. You may zero your rifle if you live at an elevation of sea level to 1,000 or 2,000 feet, and you went to the range and you shot long range and you verified and you did everything right. But you miss the point that, guess what? At 10,000 feet, it all changes. You're going to miss.
Right.
You know, as air density shifts, you know, the effects on that bullet are going to change. And I'm probably getting way too deep and ahead of myself on that. But I'll let it go back to Mitchell now.
Yeah, we talk about our dope. So you do the best you can to get input to get a good zero. You got a good BC, muzzle velocity. And now you have to go out and shoot. You can't just trust it.
Yeah.
So you need to shoot at 300 yards, 400, 500, 600. As far as, you know, you want to, just depends on what you want to do. But you write down.
I got to jump in.
Go.
Sorry to cut you off, but you just made a thought come to my mind. I've seen this play out from people calling in, and I'm not going to name names, but I've even seen it from industry people that should know better. I've seen people think the opposite of what you just said. I zeroed my gun. They understand that. They're experienced hunters. They zeroed their gun. They have a muzzle velocity. Maybe they even have an accurate muzzle velocity from a chronograph. I've got this cool new scope with this turret, and I can get it cut into yardage, right? I don't have time to go to the range. I don't have time to go to the field. I understand enough to even know that I can run my calculation and my trajectory, and it's telling me that at 500 yards, I need X amount of MOA correction, and at 800 yards, I need X amount. And I decide I'm just going to roll with it. I'm going to send that data off or fill it out on that scope manufacturer's website. They're going to cut me a turret in yardage, send it back. I'm going to slap it on my scope and kill an elk at 800 yards.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
It's really funny that you brought that up, because, like, I was going to ask about a certain type of dial system that you can get from manufacturers, and you answered it without me even having to ask. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And they can be useful, but you have to understand their limitations. I personally like to leave the turret in, whether it's MOA or mils.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting ahead on the equipment because I have some opinions there, because it does change. You know, you can, if I hunt the same location, yeah, you know, or if you're willing to get multiple turrets cut, I can totally see the advantage of a yardage-based turret. They're simple.
Well, and one of the scope manufacturers, and one that I'm assuming that you allude to, right? I've gotten their dials before. I've verified it. I will say that at distances. But one of the things they want you to always do, right, is like put your temperature, and then they say that it can basically be 20 degrees on both sides of that.
Right.
And then they also want you to give your kind of your mean altitude of what you think, yep, that you're going to be at. And I think that they say you can be kind of 1,500 feet,
yeah,
on both sides of that.
You can, and they're right. You're just, with every change of condition,
right,
you're just accepting a bigger margin of error,
mm-hmm,
right? And these yardage cut turrets are, they're awesome.
Yeah.
They're super useful.
Yeah.
I mean, I
very
love it when
easy
I can,
to use, right,
right? I can say it's 500 yards. I go to the five.
Right.
I don't have to like, it's 500 yards. I look at my chart or I look at my phone or wherever you're getting the data. And now, okay, that's 12 MOA. I got to dial 12 MOA.
MOA or clicks?
Yeah.
MOAs.
MOAs. No.
Sorry.
No, you're good. So I'm not dogging on the yardage cut turret. Don't take that wrong. It's that before you take the time to go cut the turret, go to the range, verify, true up the data, and then have the turret cut in yardage to that data.
Yep.
But recognize and understand that that is only good within an acceptable margin of error to the conditions that you verified.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and kind of what you were saying about like having potentially multiple different turrets for that exact same gun, exact same bullet, all that type of stuff for again, depending if you're hunting at 2,000 feet or 8,000 feet or 14,000 feet, right?
Right.
Like, I mean, that's major swings, and you're probably going to have a lot of major weather swings as well.
And I think out to 500-600 yards, you know, I live at 6,000 feet.
Right.
My range that I use all the time is pretty much right there, 6,000 feet. And if I'm in a hunt between 5,000 and 7,000 to 8,000 feet, I can go off that average. And out to 500-600 yards, it's within an acceptable margin of error to be completely, you know, adequate and useful.
Yeah.
But if I'm going to Texas, you know, or I'm going to some high mountain range in Colorado and I'm going to be 2,000 feet versus 12,000 feet, you know, yeah, you're definitely going to want two different turrets cut or just have the turret and MOA and do the difference of calculation.
Exactly. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
So as I was saying,
sorry.
You enter all your info the best you can. You go shoot. You got to get your zero, and then you got to go out to distance. And say you're just shooting steel. You want to shoot at 1,000 yards. So you shoot increments, maybe every 100 yards out to 1,000. Well, write down how much you dialed up and then the actual impact. And then you'll go back, and it's going to be different. It's not going to be perfect. And it could be the air density you're not measuring correctly. Maybe your app or weather is telling you it's 60 degrees when really it's 75. It can be velocity. It can be BC. If you dial up 10 MOAs,
MOA, don't say that.
10 MOA, it might not dial 10 MOA. It might be 10.5.
Right.
Better scopes, better equipment will be closer to that, but it's never going to be perfect. So there's all these variations in your solver. So you have to adjust for that. So you shoot out at those distances, record what you did, and now, and you don't have to, some apps, a lot of them have features where you can true, you can tell it where what you dial to and the actual impact, and it'll update your BC or muzzle velocity. I like to just go in manually and fidget with numbers until it lines up, but you have to do that. You don't trust the ballistic app. You get your zero, you go shoot, and then you adjust.
Yeah,
is there any ballistic app that you would trust?
A few. I like GeoBallistics.
Okay, GeoBallistics.
I've used that for a couple of years. We've worked with the Vortex guys. They got our library in there. I used Straylock before that. I think it's banned now.
I hate Straylock. I won't.
It's a Russian app, so it got taken off a couple of years ago.
It was colluding with other apps.
Yeah. It could have been.
Now Applied Ballistics makes a good app. GeoBallistics makes a good app. Now there's options out there. But I had a thought, now I just lost it.
Sorry.
No, you're good. It'll come to me.
I was trying to see if Mitchell wanted to like give any little red herrings or anything. But
yeah, I kind of thought you were going somewhere there too, and got disappointed. I don't want to say too much.
He's so tight-lipped over there.
Yeah, I don't want to get my hand slapped.
All right. Well,
we're using some other apps too.
We'll leave it
there.
At
you
that.
Go. Okay. I feel like we were all over the place there.
It's hard not to go all over the place in this conversation.
It's so
you can go
basic. It's
right.
You kind of got to go into each.
Right. Yeah. I feel like the listeners need some like homework or something to go do before we have part two of deeper dives into long range or something, right? Like
we could write out assignments and
yeah.
You can send Greg Sloan an essay on long range
shooting. There you go.
What did you learn? I guess, I mean, we could talk a little bit more about equipment. I know that, you know, we briefly hit on it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that it's just important, right, to, yes, we want to talk about like intro to long range shooting, but it's more about the person, right? It's so person, gun, ammo dependent, right? That like it's not like a turnkey thing for anyone.
Yeah.
I don't think. And I think that's really important to understand. And that's what everybody was kind of getting at. And that's why I joked around of saying like, well, it sounds like nobody should be long range shooting because, you know, talk to you and it's like, well, it could be this easy. You talk to Mitchell and he's like, basically you're screwed unless you absolutely have Doppler data and you know, 10,000 rounds down range to be able to verify everything. So there's a lot of middle ground there. Yeah, right?
I think I generally like to be a little more just practical perspective, common sense,
right,
is how I approach it. And that's why I think it comes down to it. Just understand your equipment, understand your own limitations, be honest with yourself.
Exactly.
Be willing to put those limitations on yourself in the field.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a time to showboat and say, look how awesome I am. I killed this animal X yardage.
Mm-hmm.
But it is capable, like it's possible, right?
Right.
The people that put in the time, that acquire the equipment, to spend the time in the field and have the self-control to understand their own limitations,
yep,
and the equipment and the variables. You know, yeah, you can engage targets, including game, at extended ranges.
Right.
What that means, you know, it's hard to put an exact number on. You brought up kind of that 500 yards and in. For most people, even that have the right equipment and do the training and understand it, that's probably a pretty good number.
Yeah.
You could argue you can maybe push it to 600-700 yards in the right scenario, especially with wind. Most people, I've shot enough matches with people that shoot a lot of matches and have a lot of really nice equipment and spend a lot of time at the range, and I've watched them on stage one of first round impact on targets past 700 yards, and guess what? You probably see more misses than hits, if we're being honest with ourselves.
Well, what was interesting is as you kind of brought that up, I mean, I won't say the person that I've hunted with in the past, but they are a extremely experienced match shooter, extremely decorated match shooter. And then you put them into a hunting situation and it's like 150 yards and they lose their mind in that situation just to shoot something, right?
Yeah.
So it's super interesting how, you know, this person that could go up and shoot 1,400 yards, 1,200 yards, whatever that is, have first-round impact, shoot tiny groups, all this, can be cool, calm under that type of pressure, which to me, it's funny. I would almost feel more pressure in that situation than I would on the hunting situation. But then you reverse it, right? So, again, I know that we're definitely kind of beating a dead horse here, right? Is like, it's all about like putting limitations on yourself and just being honest with your equipment and what you can do with it versus, you know, just throwing a number out there. Like, I want to be able to shoot to 600 yards and call it good.
Yeah, for sure. I did finally, it came to me, my thought earlier. I will go back to it quickly before I lose it again. To Mitchell's point about go out and verify and get that field data, and then, you know, now it's verified. You can go in the field, whether it's you're going on a hunt or you are getting a turret cutting yardage or whatever. I would just bring up, get a big enough sample size. You know, just because you went and hit a target one time at 700 yards, don't take that as the gospel
every
truth.
Time.
That's my 700-yard dope. Go repeat it.
Right.
Do a couple range sessions, you know.
I'm this super just, guilty with that.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to conserve ammo. I have a barrel burner of a cartridge.
Used to.
I ripped the barrel off. But, yeah, I shoot once. I'm like, okay, that's good.
Yeah,
and in reality, your group size at 700 yards, it's pretty big. So don't make adjustments off one shot.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Shoot a group at 700 yards and go off the group center to know where your actual drop is and your correction. And understand that. Go repeat it again a week later, 2 weeks later.
Right.
Is it repeatable?
Yeah.
Those are the kind of steps you need to go through and more to be able to really become proficient at this.
Right.
So on that note, I check my dope after every hunt. You would not believe how many times my zero has come off. Mm. It's such an easy thing to do. You drop your rifle. Maybe your action screws aren't quite tight. Anything
can
happen. Your
goat lays on top of your rifle.
That's happened before.
There you go.
But yeah, even after hunts, I go check. And it gives you more data points too. If it doesn't shift, then I get more data points to my trajectory. But things change.
So I am going to share a story here, I decided.
Okay.
You guys were honest.
I was gonna wait to finish it on this.
Okay, we can.
So I have one quick question before we get to that. All right. When I was archery hunting a lot more than I do now, I always had this thought process that, like, if I wanted to be extremely effective at, let's say, 40, 50 yards that I wanted to shoot an animal at, that I would push myself in the off season to shoot 80, 100, 120 yards, right? Because I always had this, again, thought process, or probably made up thing that doesn't make any sense to anybody else, but we'll see. That if I shot at 120 yards, if I came back to 50, 50 felt like it was a chip shot.
Yeah.
Right. So, and same thing, 40, 30, blah, blah, blah. So my question is do you think that that could be relevant in shooting a rifle, shooting a handgun, whatever that it is, that if you are constantly practicing at that very far extended range, that then your 400 yard just becomes that much easier, and that you'll be surprised how well you can be at 400 yards. Where before, let's say that you were shooting a 4-inch group, right? A 1 MO8 group at 400 yards. But then all of a sudden you start shooting at 8 to 1,000, you know, something like that. And then you come back to 400 and all of a sudden now you see it at 2.5 or something.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's absolutely. And I think it's a super good recommendation to do. The only thing I would bring up is don't only focus on the 1,000 yards.
Right.
Like, it's everyone wants to do that. If you've never shot a target at 1,000 yards, it's awesome.
Right.
It's satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, you go to the range. I've taken a lot of new shooters to the range, and you put them on still. You know, say these are people that have never shot past 300-400 yards. Mm-hmm. And you put them on still at 1,000 yards or 1,200 yards or even a mile. I mean, we have a still plate at 1,900 yards where we shoot.
Yeah.
And absolutely, it's not for hunting at all. You know, like I said, 500, 600, 700 yards to me, it's where most people should be.
Yeah.
You know, and even most equipment, you know, the people don't understand what it's required to take the ethics out of it. From a pure science perspective, you know, retain velocity for bullet function and expansion that's consistent. It's not much further than that. The most things start to fail.
Yeah.
But anyways, they want to go to 1,000.
Yeah.
Right. And you take them to the range and it's like, next thing you know, they don't want to come closer.
Right.
So absolutely shoot at 700, 800, 900, shoot at 1,000, get that experience, build that data, but don't forget to shoot 3, 4, 5, because those are the distances you're probably going to
shoot. And also what I was going to say is that this also gives you the opportunity to see if that scope is going to fail on you, right? As you dial up to 1,000 and then all of a sudden you dial back to your zero, or dial it back down to 250 or something like that. And like, see where your impact is. If it ends up being 2 inches high, then you know that there's something wrong in your scope as well, right? Or that you have data points. So by doing that and jumping around and shooting at all these different distances, again, to go back to Mitchell's point, right? It's just data points for you to then be able to put into your ballistic solver, your app, whatever that it is, to be able to do that. So
yeah, for sure.
I think that was a good kind of wrap on this, right? And then I would love to hear your story that you want to.
I'm only doing this because Mitchell he started out being honest with himself. So this one hurts. This
Dale still hasn't.
He kind of shared. He talked about.
I did share.
But you didn't miss.
Yeah, but I was. So I guess what I was trying to do.
What I was trying to do. Miss.
That's tough.
You've never missed.
I didn't say that. I will say that I don't think that I've had some near misses. Actually, with that same exact rifle, it was funny. So to go back to that bear thing, I had verified that rifle, that scope, that ammo, out to 1,000 yards, right, and that turret and everything. And before I get my hand slapped by Greg, it was one of the turrets that you're talking about that does exactly what we were saying, that he basically says it's a piece of crap and shouldn't do it. But
no, they're usable. You just got to understand their limitations.
You
got to
get your dope first, use them, understand limitations.
So I had verified actually like 2 days prior. We were hunting in Montana and had an opportunity. It was slow. It was middle of the day. I was like, I'm just going to shoot some rocks because I've got ammo to burn and I want to verify some stuff. So I like verified out to like 998 or something like that, essentially 1,000 yards. And then 2 days later, ended up getting on this mule deer buck, bedded. I think it was like 420 yards, not very far, you know, but like dialed to 425. And he was bedded. And I consider that more on me of like where my hold was and dialing. And I essentially spined the buck like in his, you know, in his bed. Never took a step, right? Died. But like, that was a lot on me of like where to hold. And this is a whole other podcast topic of like shooting broadside versus quartering away, quartering to bedded, blah, 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 right? Of like where you need to hold for your impact. So I'm not trying to like tout myself as this amazing shooter. I'm definitely not. I think I can kind of hold my own, right? But like, I'm not an amazing shooter. But it would be very hard for me to think back when the last time that I missed on something that I shouldn't have.
I think I could do a whole podcast on like misses.
Maybe you should spend more time at the range.
I should.
Maybe you shouldn't be doing those one shot verifications.
Yeah, I know. I'll get better. I'll learn.
There you go. All right. So anyways, Mitchell's inspired me because he was so upfront with his failure. This one hurts and it's not even me. I wasn't the shooter, but I take responsibility. This was almost a decade ago. My mom actually had an awesome mule deer tag in the state of Utah. And she grew up around hunting her whole life. You know, when she was a kid with her family and as we were raised, we always hunted. But she never hunted herself at all. Never had her own tag. So this tag was literally the one and only time she'd ever actually had her own tag and killed an animal. But anyways, we took time. We shot at the range. She used one of my rifles. You know, we understood the limitations of her as a shooter and equipment, but we had an opportunity on a really good deer. We glassed up. It bedded down. We were patient. We waited across this canyon. I think it was over an hour we waited. Finally, the buck walked out into the clearing. She was dead steady on a tripod. You know, it'd been ranged. It was at a distance that was requiring a correction for drop. Dialed the turret. We had her shoot. We had at least two of us on spotting scopes, videoing it.
Mm-hmm.
No impact, whatever. Mm-hmm. The deer's still standing there, and it's like no call. You know, and this deer's on a hill across from us.
Yeah.
So we should easily be able to see where the bullet's impacting. And it was kind of like in the moment, you're just not thinking clearly.
Yeah.
And it's like, what happened? So it was like, shoot it again, you know, not, hey, let's stop and think.
Right.
So she racks another one in, she shoots again. Same thing, nothing. No call whatsoever.
Mm.
By now the deer walks off. My dad and my brother, they drop down the canyon, they start up the other side. They're going to go verify, make sure there's no blood, make sure there was no, you know, who knows? Yeah, at this point, we're pretty much just baffled. We didn't know what happened.
Yep.
I'm frustrated, you know, because of the missed opportunity. I'm not frustrated at my mom. I'm just, you know, a lot finally worked out to get her on a good buck.
Yeah.
So we're sitting there, and I'm the ballistic guy, right? It's my gun. I'm sitting there trying to figure it all out. Well, in just sitting there kind of trying to work through what happened, I happened to go back to the gun. And okay, I'm going to go return it back to zero because we dialed up a given amount of mils.
Yeah.
The scope was mil-based. I use mils because I'm civilized. MOA, we won't get into that.
MOAs.
But anyways, I dial it back down to zero. And all of a sudden, guess what? I didn't hit my zero stop.
Just kept going.
A whole other revolution, it kept going.
Whoa.
So come to find out, at some point, whether it was at the range and we never went back to zero the last time we shot the gun, or whether it was somebody, I'm going to blame somebody else, had been, I don't know. It had been
hunted with one of your kids or something playing with it, right?
A kid, a grandkid, somebody at some point had dialed this turret.
Yeah.
So when I had originally made the correction, it was 2.5 mils. I dial up 2.5 mils, not knowing that we were already one full revolution off to begin with.
Wow.
So now I'm doing a bunch of other math and calculations. And guess what? Yeah, we shot way over that deer.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, it was low enough on the hillside, because then I had a panic moment of, she just launched 2 bullets over the top of that mountain.
Yeah.
So there's that whole thing. Did the math. I figured out where the drop should have been. And like I said, we actually had a phone scope running. I went back and watched the video. And sure enough, I kid you not, about 15 to 20 feet above the deer, impact number one.
Wow.
A couple of seconds later, impact number two, same spot. Crazy. We were off a full revolution. And that still haunts me to this day because of the missed opportunity on that deer.
Yeah.
I've changed scopes since then. At that time, it was a scope that didn't have a good indicator on to what revolution you were on if you were past more than one revolution.
Yeah.
It also didn't have a good hard zero stop. It was one of those that was mushy at best.
Yeah.
And you actually had to kind of go past the zero and then back. So we've learned some things since then. Like I said, this is almost a decade ago. But there's my bad experience with an attempted shot on long range hunting.
How big was the deer?
It was a solid, no question asked. It was a 185 to 190 inch mule deer.
Did she end up killing a good buck on that hunt?
She ended up killing a buck on that hunt.
Oh,
yeah.
Got it.
So that's why it probably hurts a little more too.
Right.
Fun hunt, good memories regardless. She hunted her guts out. She stuck it out a lot of days, more than most non-hunters ever would have. In the end, we just found her a cool 4-point and she killed it and had a good time. But
nice.
It was not the level of deer that she missed. We'll put it that way.
It's rough.
Yeah.
All right. As soon as Greg started talking, I thought I remembered a miss, and it was from last season. So apparently, you know, what do they say about like golfers, right? Like you're only as good as like your next shot. Like you don't have to think about the last shot that you had missed or hit bad or something like that. So maybe that's what I have, is I have short-term memory loss.
Block them out.
Exactly. Right. Like just move on. I don't think it's like the worst miss of my life. I'm sure that I probably have another one that I missed a big buck or something in some point, but I actually missed a white-tailed doe at 75-ish yards. I will say it was offhand, but there. A recent miss.
You said you missed a turkey this year too, didn't you?
I did miss a turkey this year, but that's a whole other story.
It wasn't Barnes ammo.
It was not Barnes ammo. I missed this white-tailed doe with harvest stuff, but I will say it was offhand, and she was, I bumped her, you know, I was walking river bottoms just to see if I could kick up some deer, and ended up kicking up a doe and was just trying to fill it doe tech. And I missed her the first shot, and then I neck shot her the second shot and dropped her in the tracks.
So there you go.
There's that. I did miss turkey this year, and that was just, I have no idea what happened other than I called this bird into like, it couldn't have been more than 12 yards, right? And I was shooting a 12 gauge, you know, 3-inch TTSS, right? Or TSS.
TTSX?
TTSX, like
copper bullet?
Yeah. TSS, you know what I mean? Sorry. There's just so many T's and S's and everything running around. Super tight choke, right? Because most of the time my shots are 40-ish yards, I'd say.
I can see that.
So, and also I've moved to shooting a red dot on my turkey guns. So when you do that, and when you're within that 20-yard range, it's probably the size of my fist, right? Your pattern is. And I think that it just happened so fast that bird came over the top, and I was just like, it was kind of one of those, like, you had to move to it because I wasn't expecting a bird to be right there when it happened, and I whiffed on a bird. So I made up for it and shot a double 2 weeks later or whatever. So there's that.
Had to get a few misses out of you.
Thanks. And I totally forgot that I missed that bird earlier this year too.
I'm opposite. I remember every miss, and they just haunt me.
Yeah.
I missed a bear, too, at like 300 yards. I was dying. I thought my heart was going to explode. That's my excuse.
That was prior to killing a bear.
Yeah. That was 2 years ago. I thought I was going
to
die.
You shouldn't even have to think about it because you killed a bear this season.
It's true.
One shot.
Mm-hmm. I can get pretty wound up in the moment. Like, I'm a pretty okay shot, and I do a lot of shooting, but in the moment, in the field, I have to keep a calm head.
Bug fever.
I get a little wound up. My big bull that I've killed in Utah with my limited entry tag, I killed it. So there's that, but we won't talk about the first shot. But, yeah.
All right, guys. Well, thanks. I think that we're going to do a little bit more in depth. I would love to hear from the audience if they want more topics like this. Do they want more fun stories? Do they want more product-centric type of things? I'm sure that they're just going to say, just keep them coming. But appreciate everybody's time today. Greg, Mitchell. I don't know about Mitchell's, but Greg, I appreciate your time time that you're on this thing.
I appreciate it.
Very nice.
Hope you guys are having fun, and thanks for listening to the Barnes Bullet Points podcast.